7:40 here on the Mighty 690, and it is time for our weekly chat. Maybe the last one of the year, in fact, from the folks for K-State Research and Extension, since I don't think we're going to have anyone next week, which is fine. I think everyone should take some time off, so that's good. We do have, we're going to start out first with Holly Miner, Health, Food, Safety, and Nutrition Agent for the Wildcat District. How are you doing, Holly?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing well. Good to have you on here. And I know people always enjoy it when you're on, and just let people know we will be taking calls here in a little bit. So if you have questions, start kind of thinking of them now. So, but this is continuing. You know, we had our Thanksgiving chat a couple weeks ago about food safety, but Christmas, another big holiday coming up. We want to make sure that we are safe and everything, but so that's a few of the things we're going to talk about. So I'm glad you're here today and not tomorrow, because it's going to be bad weather-wise.
Yeah, today would be a much better day, I think, to travel. So, yeah. That's so we're going to talk about holiday meats. We talked a lot about turkey at Thanksgiving time, which I think turkey is pretty traditional at Thanksgiving time. And then when we get into the other holidays, there's different meats that we might think about. We might think about prime rib, or we might think about ham, or we might think about pork loin. So a lot of those different kinds of meats and how we cook those, and then of course how we store our leftovers. So if anybody has questions about any of those things and they want to call in, I think we'll take some questions this morning, and then I'll talk about some different things in between.
That sounds great. So if you do have a question, 620-251-6909 is the number, or 1-800-252-5443. If you've got a question for Holly, this is a great time to do it, as we, you know, prepare for our holiday meals and everything. You know, people cook all sorts of different stuff. It seems like, you know, Thanksgiving's pretty traditional, but sometimes on Christmas people kind of mix things up. I mean, sometimes we'll have kind of a Christmas Eve dinner that might be a little different. I mean, we've had Cornish game hens before, and you know, when you're cooking things that are a little bit different, maybe you're not used to cooking before, you might want to be careful on, you know, how you prepare those different items, because people will try all sorts of different things, maybe duck or something like that.
Yeah.
It can be all, yep, you know, different.
Yeah, and if you're a hunter, you might have duck or goose, or you might even have deer meat. So there's all sorts of different things that come into play, and we want to make sure that everybody cooks their food to an internal temperature that makes it safe to eat. With meats, depending on the kind of meat it is, the internal temperature will vary. Poultry is always going to be 165 degrees. It doesn't matter what kind of poultry it is, whether it's duck, goose, chicken, turkey, Cornish hens, like you said, or anything else, always 165 degrees. And then when we get into things like ham or beef, those kinds of things, the temperature changes a little bit. And depending on whether there's a bone in or a bone out, the cooking time may vary. So, you know, the times and temperatures are a little bit different. Usually on a roast, or a round roast, a ribeye, a tenderloin roast, those kind of roasts are going to be 145 degrees.
Okay.
So we want to make sure the internal temperature is 145 with that. Lamb is another product that, another type of meat that people might have during the holidays, especially this time of year, 145 degrees for that as well. Whether that's a crown roast or a leg of lamb or boneless lamb, bone in, bone out, either way. So 145 for that. Same with pork, a pork loin, a pork crown roast, or a tenderloin, all of those could be 145 degrees internal temperature. And we usually cook those around 325 to 375 degrees. Depending on the number of pounds, it could be anywhere from a half an hour to an hour.
Now on the pork, hasn't there been some changes recently, and by I say recently, in like the last 30 years, on the recommendations for pork on the temperature? Was there any change at all on that, or has it been pretty consistent?
I'm not sure about that.
Okay. I thought I remember hearing something like about that they had changed a few recommendations, you know, and again, nothing like super recently.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what it used to be a long time ago, but I know since I've been involved in food safety. It's always been 145. One thing that has changed over the years, though, is the amount of fat on your meats, and they've become a lot leaner. Pork and beef have both become a lot leaner. They're more desirable meats to have now because they are those leaner. They have a lot more leaner cuts. We want to make sure that we still have marbling, and I'm sure Wendy can talk to marbling and how that all goes. But, you know, you want to have those little veins of fat running through that meat. That's going to make it tender. It's going to give it more flavor. It's going to make it juicier, and it's not going to dry out as much. Well, so,
and there are some tastes are different depending on some countries, even I've heard, want different marbling. You know, like I think there was a story. It was either Japan or China or whatever. But they for their actual stir fry and everything, they wanted specific kinds of marbling and that sort of thing. So I just thought that was kind of interesting. I also have a question here from actually Steph here in the office. She was wondering if you have any tips specifically for prime rib.
Yeah, so prime rib is one of those foods that we can cook low and slow. So the temperature can be a little bit lower and you can cook it a little bit longer. And it would need to set for 4 minutes. Specific times, I don't have my chart that has specific times and how long that you would want to cook that. And for it, you know, it would depend on how many pounds of meat is in that as well. Oh, she's standing here in the doorway, so
listening.
I can see her. so just 325 degrees. Use your meat thermometer. Everybody should have a meat thermometer. If they don't, they need to purchase one, or that should be a stocking stuffer this year for Christmas. Have your meat thermometer out, and then, if you want rare or medium rare, well done or well, you know, all of those temperatures, you would just cook it a little bit longer to get it to that point. So the temperature on a prime rib should be, let me look here, see if I can find it. I'm not seeing prime rib. Well, I guess 145 degrees, okay. And then depending on how you let it set for 3 minutes at that temperature to make sure that all the bacteria is killed. So, yeah.
So, yeah, three minutes at
145.
Yeah, okay, got it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep. And like I said, you can cook it real low temperature, and that'll help cook it slow, and it'll stay tender. Make sure you tent it or cover it a little bit to keep the moisture in. You know, when we cook in the oven, it's a dry heat. Mm. So we want to make sure that we're doing everything that we can to keep that moisture in the food.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Holly, for that. It was a good question, Steph. And if you do have questions for Holly Miner here from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District, this is a great time to give her a call because she is the health, food safety, and nutrition agent, so she can answer a wide variety of questions. So a wonderful opportunity for you at 620-251-6909 or 1-800-252-5443. And Holly, another thing that I have run into here basically in the past year is sous vide. Like where, you know, the whole process there. And I just thought it was a very interesting cooking process. Do you have any experience with that?
I don't have any experience with that. Wendy, do you have any experience with that?
Not a lot. I have some family members that have used it in the past, and more or less to keep food warm rather than to cook it. So it's not something I do.
Yeah, I looked at it and I was like, oh, well, I don't want to spend that much on that. But but it's really good. I mean, I have had it a couple times and I just was impressed. But yeah, we're talking about, consumers' tastes have, changed a little bit over the years with their amount of fat content you were talking about. And I just think it's interesting that we have changed. And Wendy, I don't know, is it from, is this producers reacting to consumers' needs as far as the fat content? Is this depending on how we're feeding animals? What has caused this? Do you know?
So a lot of it is going to be our feeding efficiency has really increased over the years. We've learned different rations will, increase gain or make an animal healthier. reach a max our potential weight sooner, things like that. And ingredients are, we have to work with what we have available. So what was available 30 years ago might not be completely available right now. So right now we have a lot of corn that we work with, and dried distillers grain, like from ethanol plants and things like that. And so we use what we have in the area. And so that's going to be a big impact on how our product turns out. An interesting tidbit about the prime rib. My favorite cut of meat is the ribeye, and I love it as a steak. And so it surprises me that people want it as a roast, and it's a holiday tradition, this prime rib. And I'm like, oh, it could be such a beautiful steak.
Oh my goodness. Right. Right. And by the way, livestock production agent Wendy Powell didn't introduce you there, but
that's okay.
Your question is welcome at 620-251-6999, 1-800-252-5443. Time to get a call in if you have any questions. Also, Brian actually just asked me the question about Wagyu beef on the market and that emergence. That's sort of new, isn't it? Or
yeah, it's kind of been out there. So it's a breed of cattle, and they have a different muscle texture. So they're similar to our regular breeds, but it's from Asia, and we do have some livestock producers in our area that raise some. And there's a couple of different varieties of that breed.
There was an embargo on them for years.
Yes.
You could not get Wagyu beef out of Japan until the, I believe it was the University of Texas, got a heifer out. And then eventually the University of Washington got a bull. So, and that was in the late 80s. And so then we were able to develop our own American Wagyu,
mm-hmm.
and it's really emerging, I think, as a direct-to-market type of thing for producers.
Some of those niche markets, for sure. Yeah, so they...
Very high-end,
yes. So they're kind of a smaller animal, not as big as our typical Simmental or Angus breed. And
longer
so...
feeding times, different types of food that they feed them, a more carbohydrate-based diet, very beginning of their feeding cycle.
I don't know that they're raised differently.
No, they actually rub them down physically.
Oh, maybe over there.
In Japan. Yeah. We don't do all that.
Yeah,
junk
they do like
here,
massages, but, and yeah,
yeah,
it's all fancy.
We don't have time for that here.
Yeah. Well, here, we're America. Yeah. We got
it. For a 7-pound loin, they just sold one on eBay for $14,000. A 14-pound
That's wild.
That's a lot.
Yeah,
that's a lot.
No,
yeah.
It's just
our producer in America is going to want a little more realistic cut of meat for their Christmas dinner or their holiday dinner, I think.
Yeah.
And there are good choices of different things. We can, ham is another one that we can talk about. Sorry, Wendy, I'll let you go on with your Wagyu if you want to, but ham, we want to make sure there's two different kinds. So there's ham that's already fully cooked, and then there's ham that has not been cooked.
Ooh, that's a good, let's go. That's interesting, because you've got the ones that, so the fully cooked ones, you're kind of just reheating in the oven, right?
That's right. You're reheating that in the oven. You want to get that temperature up to 140 degrees. And if it's one that has not been cooked, then you want to make sure that you're reheating that to 145 degrees. So, depending on the weight of the ham, it's 18 to 20 minutes per pound. So you can kind of calculate how many hours it might take to be in the oven based on the size of the ham. And, making sure that you're using that food thermometer to get it to the temperature that it needs to be at so that we know that it's safe to eat. And then once we have eaten our holiday meal and we're ready to sit back and relax for the afternoon or enjoy family time together, we want to make sure that we are putting that food away, those leftovers, back in the refrigerator within 2 hours of when they're served. So, getting up right away when you're done eating your meal and starting to put those leftovers away and get them back in the fridge.
Yeah, I know a lot of people would like to kind of check out once the meal is done, but no, you still got an important job to do. You can leave the dishes for a while, But get that stuff in the fridge.
That's right. And it doesn't mean just the meat either. It's the salads and all the side dishes that go along with that. Everything needs to be refrigerated. You were talking earlier about some of the specialty things that people have. A lot of times on Christmas Eve, people will have soups or stews, chili, those kinds of things. And so if they're making those in a crock pot, we want to make sure they're taking it out of the crock pot and putting it in a shallow container to refrigerate it. If we leave it in that crock pot, it's not going to cool down fast enough to prevent the bacteria from growing. And everything has bacteria in it. Bacteria doubles about every 15 to 20 minutes. So if you take one bacteria in an hour, it's going to be 2, 4, 8. It's going to be 16 bacteria. And then you start doubling 16. Your numbers go up pretty quick when you start doing that. So we want to make sure that that food gets back in the refrigerator right away to reduce the amount of bacteria that grows on it. And cooling it off quickly, getting it down below 41 degrees. I don't think this year it's going to be a problem setting stuff outside or in your garage if your garage is less than 40 degrees. But if your garage is heated, putting it in the garage is not an option.
Nope.
So, we want those food back into a temperature that's going to keep it safe, and below 41 degrees is where we need to be with that.
Well, Holly, always really good information. Is your office at all open to the back part of this week at all if people have questions?
So we'll be open through Friday.
Okay.
And then next week, the week in between Christmas and Thanksgiving, the university is closed, so we will be closed that week. If you have any questions, you can always call us or email us. I know I'll check my email, even though I won't be working. I'll be working at home probably a little bit, but I don't. Wendy, I'm looking at Wendy to see if what Wendy's like. I'm not working.
Yeah, I'll be available for the rest of this week.
Yeah. All right. So yeah, if people want to call the office, what's the best way to do that?
The Independence office is 620-331-2690. And to get a hold of Wendy.
Today I'm in the Independence office as well. But then my regular office is out of Altamont, 620-784-5337.
Okay, well, very good. Well, we look forward to talking, of course, more with you, Wendy, next hour and in your segment. So we will get to the news here at the top of the hour on the Mighty 690. We have that coming up. Plus our look at local news and Fox News as well here on KGGF. 8:12 here on the Mighty 690, back with friends from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. And this segment, we're going to be talking with Wendy Powell, Livestock Production Agent. So how are you doing, Wendy?
I'm great. How are you?
Doing well. So it is going to be a cold one in the next 24 hours. So my first question was going to be, anything we can do as producers to get ready for this? Because from an animal standpoint, from a facility standpoint, any thoughts?
Yeah. So there is definitely a bigger need for energy in our livestock whenever it's cold. That's how they keep warm, is they have all of those heating mechanisms in their body that keeps them warm. So we need to be feeding those mechanisms. So dump out a little bit more grain. Providing more hay is not the solution to providing energy. That's a roughage. And so we're definitely provide some corn is high in energy. So dump out a little bit more grain for those critters. If you can provide them any wind protection, that is a huge solution just because of the wind chill factor. And we know how all of that works just on our bodies too. And it's the same for livestock. So having some wind protection for them is great. And then also preventing those animals, if you can, from getting wet. So just like with people, when we are wet, it feels cooler. And so livestock are the exact same way. So when there's a little bit of snowfall, and so there's a bit of a snow cover on the backs of those cattle, and then maybe some warm sun hits it and it starts to melt, and then it drops the temperature again, or a big wind gust comes through, that's just going to cool them off even more. So anything you can do to keep the livestock out of the wind or possibly dry, that's going to help a lot with that.
Sure. And then we are, today we're going to be 43. So I'm maybe wouldn't be as concerned about freezing large stock tanks or that sort of thing. I don't know. It's probably more of a time when you get really below, sustained below freezing temperatures, but access to water is another concern, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of livestock are watered out of ponds, and with the low pond levels that we are seeing right now, make sure you have a good spot scoped out to chop ice or a way for those animals to get to water safely. So if they can't break through the ice at the edge where they're used to being, then they will go on out into the middle of the pond, and then you have the danger of them breaking through. So have a plan for their water source. Make sure you're able to chop ice for them safely or access to a stock tank, something like that. Just have a plan for their water source.
Sure. All right, well, just something we want to make sure we're thinking about and having top of mind as we do go into these really awful wind chills coming up. I mean, it's just going to be Thursday night, air temperature of -2. We'll be down into the teens, below zero for our wind chills. So it is a good reminder here. But you're going to talk about today something a little lighter topic as we head into Christmas.
Yeah.
Reindeer.
Yeah, so I'm just kind of fascinated with the reindeer. I started researching them just a little bit, and then there's this whole research project in Alaska for reindeer, and they have a bunch of information, so I just thought I would share some of that.
So, and I was thinking, like, oh, well, Santa's the only guy who has reindeer. Everyone else, we're just like, this is a North Pole thing, but they're actually used for all sorts of stuff, I guess.
Yeah. So mostly they're used for livestock production up there, meat production, which kind of blew my mind. So all of the words for them are, you know, cows and bulls and calves, just like what we deal with here. So not really similar to white-tailed deer. They're not does or bucks. They're cows and bulls and calves. So
do they have red noses?
Well, you know, they have this really interesting nose.
Yeah, Rudolph does.
They have a really interesting nose in the fact that they have a lot of blood vessels there. So it warms the air up as the air goes into their body. And really, if you were to look at a cross-section of a nostril on a reindeer, it would look like a cinnamon roll.
Oh, that's great.
So it's all spirally inside there, and so the air has more surface to touch and warm up, and the water from the air will collect and into the bloodstream and things like that. So, yeah, they might have a little bit of a red nose from all of that extra blood flow right there.
Oh, that's great. I love it. And then, yeah, that's the other thing is we got Rudolph. We got flying reindeer. Are any reindeer of these flying? I mean, come on.
Well, I don't know that I can account for Christmas magic. And so I won't say that reindeer can't fly, but we know that bats can fly, and bats are mammals, but reindeer are not bats.
Only Santa's reindeer can fly.
Yeah.
And Rudolph. We got a peanut gallery over here. It's always good. Now, what about reindeer on an actual sleigh team? I mean, I feel like they can do anything in Alaska. They do all this stuff, so... So which reindeer do we have on an actual sleigh team?
Yeah, so I found this interesting. Reindeer and caribou can actually have, both males and females will have antlers. And so we know that here in our neck of the woods, only bucks will have antlers.
Sure.
Or the males of the species. But for reindeer and caribou, both the females and the males can have antlers.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. And we also know that the bulls will shed their antlers in late November and early December. So that means if Santa's sleigh is roaming the earth in late December, then if they've got antlers, then they're going to be females.
Interesting.
Those are cows pulling that sleigh.
That is really interesting. Huh. Well, we learn something every day.
Yeah.
Even the NORAD people tracking Santa don't know that. So where are they actually found, you know, besides the North Pole?
Yeah. So originally, the Arctic Circle is kind of icy, obviously. So just a little bit south of there. So around Russia, Siberia, anywhere along in there. And I lost my place here. Sorry. So originally, there were not so many reindeer in Alaska. And so they were brought over from Russia and Siberia when the whaling happened in like the 1800s. And so the native Alaskans were losing their food source. And so reindeer were brought over in these big herds to replace that food source.
Sure. So, no, and it makes sense. I mean, they'd be suited for that environment. They're just not there geographically, but you can bring them over.
Yeah,
and use
absolutely.
Them.
So they were great in that area because their food source was the same. The population or the climate was the same. So it really worked and they've really thrived there.
Oh, that's great. And any like other features, because, you know, we complain about when we get a couple inches of snow here, but that's in Alaska, you know, they probably don't complain until they get like 10 feet or something. So any specific features that help them to navigate that?
Yeah. So I'm not sure that I've ever studied how a reindeer walks.
Right.
But I think I might try to find a YouTube video of it or something. Yeah. Because apparently they have a really high step.
Okay.
And so they can actually just kind of like step over some snow or step through a bunch
of it. Instead
of
trying to plow through it.
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
So they have a really high step. And they also have a hoof that's formed kind of in the shape of a snowshoe. I imagine this is where snowshoes actually, like, originated from. Like, oh, reindeer, they're so efficient. Let's make a shoe out of that. So they have a foot that can traverse all of the snow easily. And then also they've got hair on the bottom side of their hoof.
Really? Okay.
Which is not common at all. So it's assumed that that hair will actually just provide traction. So like if they're trying to walk across a frozen stream or a lake or something like that, that hair will actually provide some traction so they don't slip as much on those slick surfaces.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did not know really anything, honestly, about reindeer. So that's just really cool to see that an animal like that still in use, because I feel like, you know, something we might try if we were trying to, you know, use draft animals or mules or donkeys, they just wouldn't be suited for that environment.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing how our animals have really, they are put in a certain spot for a reason.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. So the other thing about reindeer that I'm fascinated with is they've got two layers of hair. And we're familiar with that with like husky dogs.
There's they have an undercoat and then that kind of water shedding top coat.
Yes. Well, that top coat is hollow. Those hairs are hollow.
Really?
And so they can swim across these big lakes. So they go on annual migrations because their food source is so spread out. So if they're swimming, it makes them more buoyant, which is just fascinating. So since we've got a little bit more time, going back to those females and their antlers.
Yeah.
The females don't shed their antlers until after they calve in like March and April. And so we've decided, researchers, when I say we, that's so that they can protect their food craters. So they've got these big old hooves, we know, and so they can dig through all of this snow to get to their forage. Well, the female reindeer are able to retain their antlers to fend off all of the others, like the bucks and whatnot, so that they can have their forage to themselves and have their nutrients they need for their babies. So I think that's incredibly fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. No, I really think it is. And it's just, you know, another thing was just so well designed, you know? So yeah, I appreciate you bringing this topic up because it's just, it's a good, you know, it's a good kind of Christmassy one.
Yeah.
And I did want to, you do have a couple, before I forget, you have a couple classes coming up, right? Want to talk about those?
Absolutely. So on January 12th, we're doing a calving school in Fredonia at the Old Iron Club. And that's going to feature an actual life-size cow that you can, we've got cameras in, and we can go through the calving process. And we've got our K-State Extension vet will be coming in, and he'll be talking about manipulating that calf coming through if there's difficult positions, how we can lend assistance to those cows that are having problems calving.
Sure.
So that's January 12th. Call any of the extension offices or go to our website for more information. We've got a weed school, Weeds of Southeast Kansas, coming up. I don't know the exact date on that, but it's in January, and it'll be at Parsons. So they'll be talking about weeds in row crops in the morning, and then the later part of the day we'll be talking about pastures. And then where there's also a corn school coming up, I don't have the date on that one either, but it's on our website as well.
Oh, gotcha. And, you know, you mentioned something that kind of spurred to mind, more on the side of the thing of weed control, pest control, that sort of thing. And I was just reading about the history of the Interstate Fair and Rodeo here in Coffeyville. Back in the late 30s, early 40s, they had mentioned a little tidbit, because it kind of breaks down the highlights of each year. I think the refinery sponsored spraying the entire fairground so that it would be fly free. So I don't know what they used, probably DDT or something like that.
Yeah.
But hey, they didn't have any flies at the 1941 Fair and Rodeo.
Wow.
I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
So, it's wild. I don't know what they use, but
I don't know, but there are products out there that can do amazing things.
Oh, sure. And that are, you know, maybe a little better for the environment.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely read the label.
Read the label. Read and follow label directions.
Yep.
So, well, hey, this is, I guess, probably our last time to have you guys in for the year.
Yes.
So I appreciate, you know, I always learn so much when y'all are in. And anything else you'd like to say as we kind of close out the program in 2022, if you can believe it?
Yeah. Just be safe out there. When you're out doing your feed routes, just make sure you have your cell phone charged and folks know where you are. Just be safe out there. It's a dangerous business to be in.
That's a really good reminder. You know, we get kind of cavalier about, you know, a lot of folks are driving out on a lot of acreage by themselves. Mm-hmm. Things can happen. So it's just a reminder, really good reminder.
Yep.
And for food safety, just make sure you're using that thermometer and getting that food up to temperature and storing it right away to get it down below 41 degrees. You know, if you're holding food, make sure you hold it at 135 degrees or higher. So,
because you don't want to spend your Christmas sick. We don't want that.
No.
We do not
want
that.
That's not a fun way to be.
No, absolutely. All right. Well, Wendy, Holly, thank you so much for joining us. And I hope you both have a very Merry Christmas.
Thank you. You too.
You as well.
Thank you. And we'll be right back with more here on the Mighty 690. Keep it here on KGGF.